This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to welcome you here to this program hosted by the Center for Studies in Higher Education. I'm Carol Crist, and I'm the director. And I am so delighted to welcome Nathan Brostrom back to campus and to talk to us about the system-wide budget. I suppose this close to the big game, I shouldn't start this introduction by saying that Nathan went to Stanford, but he did. But then he went to Princeton, to the Woodrow Wilson School. And before he came to Berkeley to be the Vice Chancellor for Administrative Services, he worked both for J.P. Morgan and for the California State Department of the Treasury, both in the areas of public finance, and then he jumped to the other side of the desk and came here and was our Vice Chancellor. OP saw his extraordinary talent, intelligence, and imagination, so hired him to be there. Vice President for Administration, and he is now, has a much bigger title than that. He's Executive Vice President, Chief Financial Officer for the University of California. And I'm so thrilled to welcome him here and to be able to host this presentation today. So welcome, Nathan.
Thank you so much, Carol. Carol was actually the provost when we first came to Berkeley, because my connection with UC preceded my time coming here. Actually, my first wife and I met at Stanford, so you can boo and hiss. She went on to get her PhD at UCLA, and then she came up here and was a professor of psychology. And Carol was the provost, and Bob Berdahl was the chancellor. She unfortunately passed away quite young. But that was actually one of the things that really cemented my my relationship and sentiment towards the campus was just the outpouring of affection and support we got from the whole campus, but especially the psychology department. And it's, you know, we have six kids, and they are all loyal bears. In fact, we moved up here in 96. And our son, David, who was just 2 years old at the time, he is now in college. But he had the chance to meet President Clinton, who was running for re-election, and all week long he practiced, hello, President Clinton, hello, President Clinton, hello, President Clinton. And then we got to the event, and he saw President Clinton, and he froze, and he said the first thing that came to his mind, go Bears! And of course, President Clinton, being President Clinton, was like, oh yeah, the Bears, look at the Bears. So, so I am going to talk today about how we create and sustain a solid and sustainable financial model. I use both terms deliberately, solid and sustainable, because we're trying to build a financial model that supports this generation of students, the cohort of students who are here now, but also one that that is sustainable. You know, the university is approaching its 150th anniversary, and we are just stewards of it for a period of time. So we want a financial model that will work for CFOs 20, 40, 60 years from now. And also, it's a small enough group, so if there are things that don't make sense, please raise your hand or ask questions, or I'd love this to be interactive. Our financial model is really grounded in the three values that we hold dearly across UC: quality, access, and affordability. And I know this is well known to many of you, but I'll just spend a few minutes of it on each. Oh, I should say, I'm also going to be talking about it from a system-wide perspective. There's room up here, Panos. I'm going to be talking about it from a system-wide perspective. So a lot of the data and a lot of the things you'll see are in the aggregate. And so there are things that will, make sense for one campus that may not make sense for another campus. So, you know, medical centers are a very good example. Medical centers are supporting us a great deal, but obviously there's only on five of the campuses. So quality, I think everyone knows about the quality of UC Berkeley. It is a top public university in the country. I think it's 17 or 18 years straight in U.S. News and World Report. But, you know, across the world, it is typically ranked in the top five in universities worldwide, whether it's Shanghai Jiaodong or the Times of London or Washington Monthly. But we enjoy similar quality and a breadth of quality across the UC system. One measure of it, there are 62 AAU institutions, Association of American Universities, 62 in the United States and Canada. Six of them are UC campuses. And that doesn't even include UCSF, which is one of the top top five medical schools in the country. No other state system has more than two. So it's really remarkable that we have this this breadth of quality. But we also do that by remaining accessible to all Californians. In this fall, 42% of our undergraduates across the whole system, 42% are Pell Grant recipients, coming from the lowest income brackets in California. About 40% are first generation, first in their families to ever go to college. And that's really remarkable. If you look at who we compete with, if you look at Stanford or Princeton, it's I just got the news. I was down at Stanford a couple weeks ago, and President Hennessey was talking about the 14% first generation. So it's an order of magnitude higher. It's also one that's been growing. I didn't realize this till a couple weeks ago, but in 1999, the number of first generation students was 19%. So even during the throes of all the financial troubles we've gone through, we've actually increased our access to low income. And then we're also affordable. And I would say we're affordable on a gross basis. I mean, our overall tuition is very low, but especially on a net basis. 55% of our students, undergraduates, pay no tuition at all. 55% pay no tuition. About half the students have no debt. And those that do take on debt graduate with about $10,000 less than the national average. But everything we do on a financial model has to be driven by these values and has to fit into one where we're not compromising access to maintain quality or the trade-off between affordability and access. I don't know if all of you saw this, but it's really nice to get external validation on some of these things. And this was actually in the New York Times 2 months ago. It actually was during a Regents meeting, which was quite helpful to be able to point out. This is really a measure of both economic diversity and social mobility across all of the campuses. So it looks at the number of Pell students, and it also looks at affordability for a middle-class cohort. How much it costs if you are, I think it's $150,000 in family in income, and it comes up with an index. Of all the universities in the United States, six of the top seven are UC campuses. And they do have a gating threshold, which is you have to have a five-year graduation rate of 75%. If they didn't have that, we would have been nine of the top 10, because Merced, Santa Cruz, and Riverside are all all highest in terms of Pell Grant recipients. I would also like to point out a couple of other things on this chart, which we're really proud of. You look at some of these schools that do make the top 10, Pomona, Amherst, Vassar, do a very good job. They enroll a lot of low-income students, but they do it in the hundreds. So Pomona's, 400, Amherst is just below 500. Across the UC system, we have 80,000 Pell Grant recipients. And so when you think of the transformational impact that has not only on the student and their family, but also on the whole state of California, it's just a different level of magnitude. I would point out this, because this is the more sobering part of it. He also runs a per-student endowment. This is going to come up later in the talk. But if you look at it, UC Irvine, which is the top, has $11,000 endowment per student. Pomona, number 10, 100 times more, $1.1 million. And when you think about the strength and the resilience of a financial model, this becomes a really big factor for universities. So the strategy that I have put together that I talk about has four basic quadrants. One is we need to have predictable state funding. We also need to have a predictable and moderate tuition plan. But those in and of themselves are not going to sustain the excellence and the access to the UC. Instead, we also have to do everything we can to generate alternative revenues within the system. And we also have to look at everything we do from an administrative standpoint and reduce those costs. And then I have I put this on the bottom because I think this is one thing we have not done that effectively is leveraging our balance sheet. And I don't think this is just UC. I think this is public higher education in general. So we've always thought of ourselves sort of as an income statement or a P&L organization. You know, how much revenue do we have coming in from the state? How much from tuition? What are our expenses? Are we in the red or the black? And then we go on from there. Well, we have a very robust balance sheet. We have $90 billion of assets. Now we have huge unfunded liabilities as well, but there are lots of things that we can be doing here to both reduce our costs and also generate more revenues. And I'll talk about those a little bit later. So let me start with predictable state funding and the moderate tuition plan. I think this is fairly well known to people, but what's really happened in the past 25 years is that the UC has been increasingly crowded out of state funding. If you look at where we are today versus where we were in 1989-90, and these are in absolute dollars, these aren't inflation adjusted, we are exactly the same in absolute funding as we were 17 years ago, when we have grown 80,000 students, we added a campus, scores of new programs and degrees. This is not really out of neglect or malice by the Sacramento. There's a little bit of that, I will admit, but more of it is just the structure of the state budget on both the revenue side and on the expenditure side. So on the revenue side, I was, as Carol mentioned, I was a public finance banker, and when we work with states, what you really wanted to see was a revenue structure that had about a third in the different buckets. So a third in income tax, a third in property tax, a third in sales tax. In the state of California right now, any guesses as how much in income tax? Two-thirds. Two-thirds of the state's revenue come from income tax. And because of the way we're structured, a lot of that is in the highest brackets. A lot of that is in capital gains. And so just by the nature of it, property tax and sales tax are much less volatile. They're much more stable. We just have an incredibly volatile revenue structure. And then on the expenditure side, we're in a state that just loves to budget by the ballot box. And so we have Prop 98, which says a certain amount of the revenue has to go to K through 14. We have federal mandates. We have, the courts taking over our prison system. And so the UC is part of an increasingly dwindling part of the state budget that's truly discretionary. You know, by some estimates, it's as low as 20 to 25%. And so when we get, when the state's going through revenue cuts, we're the first ones to get cut. And then as we found out in the last few years, because of Prop 98, we don't really get restored that much. As much as the legislature wanted to give us money, there just really wasn't a lot because of the 98. So I think, in some ways, I think the best we can do is to hope for predictable and moderate state growth. I mean, I think we should look at other possibilities and possibly a dedicated revenue stream or other opportunities. But I don't think that our salvation is going to come from the state. At the same time, we've passed on the volatility that we see from the state. We pass it on in tuition. And so if you look at the last 20 years, there were 11 years, including the current the six that we're currently in, where tuition was either flat or declining. There were 6 years where it was double digit, and only 3 years where it grew roughly by the rate of inflation. And I think this is a terrible, terrible policy. I think it's terrible for our students and our families. If you're a student at UC, depending on when you came, your tuition could have doubled during that time, or it could have been flat through no measure of your own. But it's also not fair to campus leadership. Campuses do not know what they're going to have for long-term planning. And if anything, a university needs to plan for long-term growth. So I would I would posit that a much better policy would just be to tell an incoming student, your tuition is going to grow roughly by the rate of inflation over your time here. And then this is the net outcome of what we've seen. So let me explain. This is the amount on a per student inflation adjusted basis we get from the state of California. This is the amount from tuition and fees. And this is the amount from UC general funds, which includes non-resident tuition, it includes some indirect cost recovery, it includes a few other revenue sources. So you can see a couple things. First of all, the overall cost of educating a student from core funds has decreased. It's decreased by about 20% over the last 25 years. And this runs, you know, this runs frankly counter to the national narrative. If you hear pundits or even the president talk, you know, the costs of higher education are rising out of control. Our costs have actually come down. Now, who's paying has changed dramatically. You know, 1990-91, the state paid 80% of the core funds of the cost of education. Now it's less than 40%. So the state portion has been cut in half, and students have had to pick up more. Though even this has a nuance. I mean, remember in a couple slides ago, I told you that half the students pay no tuition. So half of this green bar is coming from other sources, which includes the federal government, the state, and our own institutional aid. So it's not quite as dramatic a shift as we point out. And then the other thing that I would just preview that we have in further slides is that our actual cost of expenditures for education is actually higher than this, but it's coming from non-core sources. So I'll talk about medical centers and how much they put into medical school. So it's, yeah, I'm sorry, Celeste.
So the number there that it says that the cost per student is not actually...
This is the core funds. So this is just, I'll show you a slide that shows what those are. But one thing that we're doing, we're trying to do more, is to leverage non-core funds. Things like...
Yeah, I just wanted to know how much it costs to educate a student from 1990 to 2014.
Okay. Well, we actually did a paper that shows I can send you that includes all those sources, but on core funds, it actually has gone down. So let me tell you about what has happened recently with the state, since a lot of people are interested in that. One of the big changes I was just telling Celeste about is moving from the campus to OP. Is I used to work out most mornings with Devin Wicks back here and. Have a great workout, and now I work out in downtown Oakland, and one of my gym mates is Governor Brown, which means I often don't get much of a workout in because he wants to talk about the university. But we spent a lot of time with the governor and his folks last year, and you know, the governor has very strongly held views about the university. And Judd, I understand they go back to his first term as governor. But you know, ultimately, I think we got a pretty good framework from him that was then approved in the budget that the legislature passed. It would basically be a base budget increase of 4% each year for the next 4 years. That totals about $500 million overall. We also got $436 million in one-time money. This was from Proposition 2 that can go into our retirement plan. Assuming an introduction of a new tier with a the same cap, the income cap that the state has, we agreed to hold in-state tuition flat for 2 years. Again, I didn't agree with that, but I think it was part of getting this deal done. And then we would have what we were looking for is just moderate inflation that's generally pegged to inflation. There would be tuition increases for non-resident and professional degree programs. And then more one-time money for deferred maintenance and cap and trade. And then finally, this was not part of the budget framework, but at the legislature put in this contingent enrollment funding. So if we can demonstrate that we will enroll 5,000 more California undergraduates in 16-17 over 14-15, we'll get $25 million in the base budget. And this is something I don't want to give away. The president's, I guess she's already said it. So we are going to try to do it. We're going to try to do it through the $25 million. Plus, we're going to phase out institutional aid for non-resident students. And that will give us the funds to get the $10,000 per student. Any questions on that or?
What's sort of one question is the picture you showed for system-wide, there's a rough balance between income from tuition and what we're getting from the state. But I think Berkeley is, the pattern here is rather different because we get much more from tuition than we do from the state. I mean, it's about 3-to-1 ratio.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, how was these sort of inter-campus differences factored into the negotiations between the governor and the president? Have those been differences been taken into account?
Yeah, they have been taken into account. I will say I don't think any single campus was particularly happy but you're right, Steve. It does vary quite a bit. I mean, I think Berkeley, for example, benefited from the increases in non-resident tuition. But then the president has decided to accelerate what we call rebenching, which is ensuring that all of the state funds are allocated on a equal weighted per student basis, and so that didn't hurt Berkeley as much as it hurt like UCLA. So there were, you know, puts and takes on all the campuses, but I think Berkeley particularly was hurt by not having the in-state tuition because, you know, especially without a medical center, it doesn't have some of the other revenue sources that some of the other higher ranked UCs had. We did work a lot on some different delivery initiatives, and you know, this, I have to say, the governor was very, very focused on. I think these are all very positive. You know, at the end of the day, we are looking at ways to streamline transfers to get to the 2-to-1 ratio, 2 freshmen for every 1 transfer at all the campuses, and also take transfers from a wider array of community colleges. Right now, about 90% of our transfers come from 25 community colleges, and there are 107 around the state. Lots that we can do. I mean, we do a very good job on time to degree and graduation rates, but I think there's even more that we can do. And you know, a lot that are looking at curricular requirements and a better use of summer sessions to keep kids moving through. And then there's a lot of really fascinating things going on in predictive analytics. I'm sure many of you know about these more than I do, but just being able to predict student outcomes and help students when they are falling short in either courses or towards their or towards their time to degree. And so that is something that's going on across all of the different campuses, and I think should you know, produce some pretty favorable outcomes.
What is activity-based costing?
Oh, I knew someone was going to see that. No. This is a particular interest of the governor. There is I think he's an economist down at Stanford named Bill Massey, and he's written a book about activity-based costing. It's never actually been done anywhere. But we are doing a pilot of it at UC Riverside. It's the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, and really what it's doing is it's looking at all of the inputs that go into teaching a course. And teaching a course, whether it's a seminar, whether it's a large lecture class, whether you know it's a hybrid part online, part in class. The problem with it is it's never really been tied to learning outcomes, and so no matter what you figure out on the cost side, unless you can tie it to what students are actually learning, I don't think it has much much value. But we're going through the exercise, and we'll see what it does show us. Celeste?
I have a question about the other one, predictive analytics. So is that what goes under the name of adaptive learning in the document?
Some of it's adaptive learning, but some of it's also you know, just using systems to see when a student is not progressing well. So if a student, let's say, is in a chemistry series and they're in the first in the first course, but they don't sign up by a certain time, let's say they have a C and they don't sign up by a certain time, you know, just by the breadth of data that it's likely that they're not going to eventually sign up, and that's sort of a trigger then for, you know, a warm intervention for an advisor or professor to call and say, you know, what's going on? Have you been able to do this? And some of it it's probably probably better spent at places where the students have lower academic quality coming in. You know, we spent some time with the president of Arizona State. And they're using it quite a bit, but he said that, you know, it's really for students who are not really at Berkeley's kind of caliber. But it does have, you know, it does have some value in terms of increasing graduation rates and reducing time to degree. Okay, so now let me jump into alternative revenues. I wrote some notes down, which my team always, they write notes for me, and then I you know, always keep this crumpled up. So, but again, I think this is really what we're going to need to look at preserve the quality and the access and affordability of the UC system. So, Celeste, to your question, what I've been talking about so far, the tuition, state general funds, and UC general is really about a quarter of our overall revenue. And that's, you know, that's shrunk quite a bit. 25 years ago, it was closer to half of the revenue pie. The rest of it is made up of, you know, the rest of our enterprise, including our medical centers. A lot of this includes medical payment plans, so that's built in there. Contracts and grants, and then auxiliaries and private philanthropy. So one of the goals that we have is trying to leverage all we can in this 75% to support our core mission, to support the teaching and learning that's going on from our core revenues. One of the most immediate areas in enrollment management was non-resident tuition. And we use this quite extensively during the financial crisis. So, you know, the financial crisis really hit in the fall of 2008. And so you can see this was a period of time when we were cut $1 billion by the state. And the percentage of non-residents doubled then, and it has since tripled from that time. Non-residents, to Steve's question, really fall into three buckets. So, you know, when I'm at the legislature, I like to point out the 13.6% number. But, you know, UCLA, Berkeley, and San Diego are all over 20% in terms of the overall population. Davis, Irvine, and Santa Barbara are all between 10 and 15%. And then Merced, Santa Cruz, and Riverside are all 5% or below. So it really does fall into different buckets. And you can see relative to AAU publics or even other flagships that we're still very low. Now, I think one thing that, you know, we should take into account is that a lot of these states, Michigan, for example, first of all, they hit financial hard times long before California did. And so they had to. They also don't have a growing cohort of high school graduates. And, and California does. Is that the demand for UC continues to grow, not only because we have a growing population, but because also our completion rates, high school completion rates, are actually increasing quite dramatically, especially among Hispanic Latino students. And so we want to make sure that we remain accessible to all of these graduates. A lot of the attention goes to non-residents, but there are other areas of enrollment management that campuses are starting to look at. One is in the profile of graduate education. Berkeley produces more PhDs than any university in the country. But there are a lot of our competitors, Harvard or Stanford, do a lot with master's programs. A lot of those are revenue generating. A lot of those are needed by the workforce. So a lot of our campuses are looking at areas where they can expand master's programs, even if it means reducing the size of some of the PhD programs. Other areas, certificates, extension programs. I know Haas has done quite a bit with executive ed and other programs like that, and then self-supporting programs that do not draw on the on the state. So all of our campuses are looking at ways where they can use enrollment management to sustain academic quality, but also do it in a way that's stable revenues. Pat?
I wanted to ask a question about self-supporting programs. I understand they're increasing at the university. And so to what extent are they increasing costs to students who before this point would have had lower cost access to these programs?
That's a good question, and we'd probably have to go through it, program by program. Probably the best example of where they went through and did self-supporting was the Anderson School, when they went to a self-supporting MBA. They have not raised tuition that significantly since then. I'm not convinced that was a good decision. I mean, that's a core academic program at the university. They weren't getting that much state funding anyway, so I'm not sure what the, you know, this declaration of not taking it really got them. But I think a lot of the self-supporting programs that have arisen have been more on areas that were not being traditionally served. And so they're new programs that are arising. But it would probably be, you know, warrant going through each program to see, you know, which ones were did supplant others and which were truly complementary.
And are they mostly at the professional level, not on the undergraduate
level? They're all at the professional level. Yeah, there's no undergraduate. Well, I'll say that, and then someone will say, yes, there. But yeah, all at the professional level.
So the regents insisted that it did not include undergraduate.
I mentioned this at the beginning, but this has been an area of considerable strength. It's been an area of that we have to closely monitor. If you can see, the medical centers have been increasing both in their revenues, but also in their margins, in their net income. And a lot of this comes back to support our health sciences schools. Net income this year, 14-15, was $650 million at the medical centers. $400 million of that comes to support the health sciences schools and has been a huge benefit to those places, not only directly but also indirectly in terms of facilities, in terms of some joint hires, especially in life sciences and other other areas. But, you know, as Rory knows, when I was a banker 15 years ago, we were working with UCLA. UCLA Med Center was down to 6 days cash on hand. And they were, you know, they had a sizable loan from the campus to the Med Center to keep them afloat. There are lots of good things going on in our medical centers. They're actually starting to work much more closely as a system. They're doing a lot of things called leveraging scale for value, where they are taking a lot of the advantages that they have as a system. We're also very dependent on Medicare and Medi-Cal, which is something that we take great pride in. But, you know, especially with the exchanges and especially with some of the measures of ACA, the reimbursements there are not nearly what they are for commercial payers. And we're competing against, you know, people like Kaiser, which don't, just by definition, do not take Medi-Cal or they don't take Medi-Cal payments. So while this has been a huge benefit to, and I should also mention, this really only benefits five campuses right now. Because the way we have the financial model set up, there is not a lot of cross subsidies to the other campuses. Yeah.
Are they ruining our healthcare system too?
I'm sorry?
Aren't they ruining our healthcare system as well, the medical centers?
You mean UC Care?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're trying.
No, not really. We have a. Yeah.
You haven't heard, like, all right, never mind.
No.
As we understand it, the medical centers are trying to replace other options by a UC only healthcare.
We did introduce UC Care, which is a PPO that does benefit a lot from the medical centers, but we still have, you know, HealthNet and HealthNet and Kaiser and all the other offerings.
For now.
So, for now. Yeah.
What are the reasons that there are such a discrepancies in profit growth in San Diego and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Irvine and Davis and Austin?
I bet Rory can answer that better, but a lot of it is the profile of care. UCLA and San Diego do a lot of specialty care, a lot of tertiary and quaternary care. UCSF does as well. UCSF is constrained here because they just brought in the new hospital, and so the debt service from that is taking a big chunk of their op. But, you know, UCSF, in terms of their, I guess we don't have it broken down by revenues. Their revenues are very, very high. But their net income is constrained because of the debt service they just started to pay. Research is another area of huge strength, and it's really sustained a lot of the academic excellence at Berkeley and across all of our campuses. And we have kept it relatively flat. over the years, which is pretty remarkable given federal sequestration. But you know, there are some issues. The first is the decline in federal research. So in 10-11, just 5 years ago, it was nearly 2/3 of our research contracts and grants. 80% of that came from NIH and NSF. In the most recent year, it was below 60%. And one of the problems with that, I mean, first of all, we were able to replace it. We replaced it with foundation grants, state grants, even corporate grants. One of the big problems with that is those grants don't pay. So state of California, you know, I spent a lot of time wrangling with them about this. You know, Berkeley's indirect cost rate, I think, is 56, Rose? The state of California pays, at best, 20 cents, 20%. The Gates Foundation. We get money from the Gates Foundation. They pay 15%. And so and I won't even say full paying because, you know, the federal government's not full paying, but the more you're replacing those grants with grants that aren't paying the indirect cost recovery, you are really sapping discretionary revenue from the campuses. And then the other issue is just that our indirect cost rates on the federal rates are still low. Now, every campus, and I think Berkeley has really led the way here, has done a good job in increasing it. I mean, Berkeley has gone up from 53, I think it's 56 next year. UCSF just renegotiated it. But, you know, against Harvard, Yale, Hopkins, you know, we are 12 to 15 points below. And when you think of that on a scale that's $5 billion, that's tens of millions of dollars of discretionary revenue. So, I think we need to keep working at this, both from a technical basis, but also a political one. I mean, every time we go back to D.C., we say, why is Berkeley 14 points lower than Harvard? And there's no real good answer. I mean, the answer used to be, well, the state built all your buildings. Well, the state hasn't built any buildings in years for us, so that really doesn't suffice. But the campuses are also doing a good job of coming up with a better technical analysis. I saw the last one that Berkeley submitted, and that was really really strong. But this is an area where we could be getting, you know, tens of millions of dollars of more discretionary revenue that truly does just flow to the campus. And this is another area that I really want to focus on because I think it does offer both immediate and long-term benefits. You know, we do a fairly good job on private philanthropy, especially for a public university. $1.8 billion in fiscal year 2014. Again, this is largely focused on a few campuses. UCSF, UCLA, and Berkeley are, $1.2 billion of that. And so there's lots of campuses that don't raise much at all. But probably the bigger issue is that so little of it goes to unrestricted purposes. And, that's something, as, you know, people who raise money know, it's very, very hard now to get donors to give unrestricted dollars. But there are very, very good models, and our private counterparts use these all the time, where you can take restricted dollars, honor the donor's interests, but then also use them to support core unrestricted purposes. So, when I was at the Berkeley campus, we got that great grant from the Hewlett Foundation, $110 million to match endowed chairs. And while the sum itself was great, what was really great about it was that 75% of the payout, we increased the amount of the payout, and then 75% of that had to go to faculty salaries and graduate student support. And those were previously sources that came from core funds, from the state or tuition. We basically cribbed that and did that with the president. Did a match for endowed chairs across the system. One of the things we heard when we were doing this at Berkeley was that donors would see through this; they wouldn't like it. All of these have gone much faster than people anticipated. I think we can do the same thing in student financial support. I mean, we have $700 million in institutional financial aid, which is great and preserves everything we talked about earlier. But we don't do anything because we do that out of our own tuition. We basically tax our own students. We don't raise that much money for it. And if we could use some of that to supplant, that would free up more money for the operating budget. And then also in capital financing. You know, we have a very low cost of capital, and everything we can do to raise gifts for buildings, but then utilize our low cost of debt gives us a inherent financial advantage. So that brings us to the balance sheet and some things I think we can be doing more effectively there. First of all, this is our debt. This is the debt profile of the University of California. This purple area is what we call our general revenue debt. This is all we had 10 years ago. We only had one lien, and so this is supported by all the revenues of the university. About 10 years ago, we introduced what's called a limited project revenue bond. This is for projects that have a revenue source. So dormitories, parking structures, anything that can generate its own revenue, we have a separate lien for. And then finally, we just introduced this about 6 years ago. The goldenrod is our academic medical centers. They were growing so big that we introduced its own credit for the medical centers. So I would say that we have managed this quite effectively. Our overall cost of capital is 4%. And that includes quite a bit of taxable debt, so it's not all tax exempt. One other thing that we did this year is we issued our second century bond. A century bond sounds weird, but it is exactly what it sounds like. We issued a bond in 2015 that won't come due till 2115. It was our second one, so we've issued $1.3 billion of that. The interest rate on that was 4.76%. And so basically, it's the closest thing that we have to equity at a university. And what the reason that it's good, the reason that it's effective is that what we've done with it is campuses are taking a portion of that and using it to create revolving loan funds for deferred maintenance and capital renewal. So, you know, no one's going to have the project out for 100 years, but they can have it out for, you know, 8 years or 12 years and then keep recycling it itself. And then they don't, you know, they basically just have to pay the interest on it because the principal is so long dated. I'm going to talk about this a little bit later, but this, you know, our debt has serious constraints. And it's one of the things that is going to be, come a real challenge in the coming years. This is another area that we have really optimized, is looking at our financial assets. So the endowments, you know, have grown quite a bit. So right now, between the Regents Endowment and the campus foundations, we have about $15 billion of endowment. That's great, though, you know, we have 250,000 students, so... You know, the math on that is $60,000 across the whole system, $60,000 of endowment per student. You know, when Stanford has 1.2 million. So this is an area that we need to grow. When I first joined the university, all we had was STIP. And STIP is our short-term investment pool. It's invested entirely for safety, for liquidity. We had 24-hour notice on being able to withdraw it. It was great, but it only returned 1.6%. In 2008, we launched TRIP, called the Total Return Investment Pool. We launched it in August of 2008, and if anyone remembers that, it was probably the absolute worst time to, and I think we actually lost money in the first 6 months. And but since that time, over the last 7 years, it has averaged 8.3%. So 7% more than STIP. And when you think about that, on a $1 billion, that was $70 million. It really helped us withstand a lot during the financial crisis. We have since taken a lot of the chips off the table. We've de-risked it, but it's still meant to earn about 3% more than STIP. And this is something we're trying to move as much as we can from STIP into TRIP. And then if there are excess earnings, move it into GEP, because that's what will give us long-term resilience, is getting more money into endowment and more unrestricted money into endowment.
Nathan, did you de-risk it on a short-term basis or permanently?
Yeah. What happened, John, is that it started with 50% fixed income, 25% equities, but there was just such a run-up in equities that we weren't, it just naturally, and so just this summer we took it down to our original allocation. And then this is another thing that we did this summer. This is a very busy chart, hard to read. But, you know, as is typical, when we first introduced TRIP, you know, who immediately jumped in? UCSF, UCLA, and Berkeley. You know, and they put as much as they could in. And it was a smaller campuses. This is not, it used to be that they were all up here. And they had real reasons to not do it because they had absolute liquidity needs. It wasn't just relative. So what we did is we said we would guarantee liquidity system-wide. And that that has enabled every campus to move down. So, I mean, Riverside's gone a little crazy with it. They're down to 13% STIP now. But this is something, you know, we're able to use this broad pool to guarantee system-wide liquidity, enable every campus, and not just the big ones, to move as far down in STIP as they want. This is another area that we've used our balance sheet, and I think quite effectively. We had a very, very dramatic decline in UCRP, our pension plan. It had gone from overfunding to down. It got to as low as 72% at our lowest. We did several things. We restarted contributions. They are now fully implemented, so employees pay on the old tier, pay 8%, and university pays 14%. We had very strong investment returns, as I had mentioned. But the other thing we did is we did additional borrowing. You know, I mentioned that STIP had excess liquidity and was earning about 1.5%. Our pension is projected to earn 7.5%. And so we have borrowed on four different occasions an amount totaling $2.7 billion and put it into UCRP. And so on any given year, that's, you know, if it's a 6% arbitrage on $3 billion, that will generate $180 million that stays in UCRP. So I'm bringing to the Regents next week a proposal to do three additional years of borrowing, which we're going to do. This was the money that we are getting from the state. I mentioned the $436 million. I'll borrow the rest, and that'll accelerate our time to get to full funding. Right now, we're projected to get to 90% funding by 2025, that's, you know, that's a pretty good target to get to. Any people look perplexed? Pat, yeah.
I remember several years ago when the stability and future of UCRP was considered a major problem. Are you saying that it is no longer considered a major problem?
No, it's a problem. I shouldn't say that. It's very stable. And we're on trajectory to grow, and we're doing a lot of things to shore it up. But it's a huge problem from our operating budget. You know, 14% on our covered comp of, you know, close to $10 billion it's about $1.3, $1.4 billion a year that we're paying out of our operating budget that 6 years ago we didn't have to pay. And so it's, you know, when you think about all the other things that we could be spending it on, even if we just paid the normal costs, it would be about 8%. So that would be a lot of excess money. So I think we're doing the right thing, but it's, you know, I wish we'd started a little bit earlier, I guess.
Just one follow-up question. Do you think there's any prospect that the state will resume its contributions because it has saved billions of dollars because UC is taking charge of its own UCRP?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think this was a good start, getting the one-time money. Then the other thing they used to always raise is, well, you have a different pension system. You don't adopt our cap. You know, we're looking at doing a DB with their cap. Their arguments start to fall through. I don't think they're gonna have the money. But it is, as Pat points out, it is a big difference between us and Cal State, between us and the community colleges, is they get all their pension contributions paid directly by the state. We have to do this all out of our own resources. Celeste, yeah.
About sustainability, what guarantees that the state will give us the $170 million in 2017, 2018, not in the budget?
It will be in the governor's budget.
But it hasn't been approved by the legislature.
That's right. Yeah, and the legislature reminds me of that every time.
Like the legislature has never before overridden a governor's comment.
Yeah, I think this one would be unlikely. I mean, it's not. It could happen, and you know, the speaker has said that several times, that your framework is with the governor. But you know, first of all, it's not out of the general fund. it's out of Prop 2, so it doesn't affect any of the other programs. It has to be spent on unfunded liabilities. So I think it would be really tough for them to reverse it. And in fact, I plan to try to get more, because there is, it's Prop 2 money that's going to keep recurring, and there's no reason once we're in that we shouldn't, you know, continue to get that. And that will, because the other thing about this is that, you know, I showed you we had about $6 billion of liquidity. We can't keep borrowing like this, or we really jeopardize our short-term liquidity. So the more we can get in state contributions, the quicker we'll get to reducing our contribution. We also have a new chief investment officer, and he's a wonderful addition, Jagdeep Bacher. And one of the things he did is when he came is he looked and he said, why aren't we investing more in UC? And I said, well, you know, it's just we haven't looked at it that way. So we've started to work on several things. He's looking at a number of our energy projects and taking investments there. He's done a lot in direct real estate. He bought a... He bought a student housing complex in the middle of Isla Vista. A brave man. he bought his own building, 1111 Broadway. He bought the hotel that's on the UC Davis property. He's also looking at development. We've actually been meeting with Rose and her colleagues at looking at student housing. His point was they're invested in student housing across the country. Why are we invested in our own operations? And it really is. It's going to go a long way to help us, especially with the debt capacity constraints that I was talking about. One of the other things that he's done is looking at ways that he says, you know, we have the most amazing environment for technology and innovation. Why aren't we investing more directly? And so he started this UC Ventures program, which is going to invest in, first of all, a lot of local funds. So, San Francisco, Berkeley, Davis all have local funds looking at doing seed and angel funds for innovations that come off the campus. Then he's going to also look at doing a venture capital fund and then getting some of his existing portfolio to invest in that. And the idea is not only to look at, potential returns for our investments, but also to support our professors. And making sure that they can keep the technology in play longer. So I want to spend a little time on administrative efficiencies, but I'm going to really focus on a system-wide level. Every campus has something going on, looking at what they can do to reduce costs on the campuses. There are also some remarkable regional things going on. UCLA running financials for Merced and other campuses, Berkeley and San Francisco combining their procurement offices. The ones I'm going to look at are ones that really leverage the size and scale of UC. We have 250,000 students, nearly 150,000 faculty and staff. That's tremendous buying power. That's tremendous leverage that we have in all of our contracts. And that's the kind of thing that we need to focus on system-wide. So the first one is procurement, and I point this out because it's been, first of all, it's been incredibly successful, both from the financial and also the technology perspective. But I want to start with it because it really also has engendered a new governance and operational model. So rather than setting up a big procurement infrastructure in Oakland at OP and having it all centrally located, what our procurement officer, Bill Cooper, did is that he set it up system-wide. So he has a fairly small staff in Oakland, and then he has centers of excellence across all the campuses. So life sciences is at San Diego. Davis has IT. What do you have here, Rose? I can't remember. Is there a... And so those people have both the ownership and the stewardship of those parts of it. And it really has done wonders at making it a much more of a UC-wide procurement rather than an OP-directed. And frankly, it's the kind of governance model I think we should be using on all of our administrative practices. Energy efficiency, we've done incredibly well because we have... We've had this partnership with the investor-owned utilities for the last decade where they will give a portion of equity for energy efficiency that we've matched with some of our debt. So it's led to a lot of financial savings in terms of reducing our energy costs. And quite frankly, in a time when the state has not been funding capital or deferred maintenance, we've used it to do a lot of deferred maintenance. So if you're putting in a new HVAC system because it's more efficient and will reduce your energy, it's also a new HVAC system, which we would have had to do out of some funds anyway. So it's this is one we're actually negotiating with the IOUs to extend it and increase it now. About 3 years ago, we launched a captive insurance company, Fiat Lux. And this has been very helpful. What it really does is before we had Fiat Lux, we bought almost all of our insurance commercially. And so we paid a lot in premiums, whether it's for workers' comp or medical malpractice or general liability. And we didn't take a lot in self-insurance or in reinsurance. So because we have a captive insurance company now, we're able to enter the reinsurance market. We benefit from that. We're entering. We're also able to cross-collateralize, so we can keep lower reserves than before when we had all these different silos. And we're looking at moving into different areas of coverage. So medical malpractice for affiliated physicians is one area that we are doing. We're offering renter's insurance to our students, which was, you know, previously they had to do commercially. Gives us a lot of opportunity, both for more insurance and also less costly insurance. And then finally, you know, and a year ago, this would have got as many hisses as Stanford, but I'm very proud of this right now. Is UCPath, and UCPath, for those who don't know, is our system-wide payroll, academic personnel, timekeeping, and HR system, and I've been with it present since the creation, and it was fraught with lots of problems. And I would say probably the main problem that we didn't recognize is that a new payroll system is not a technology project. You know, you can use technology to enhance it, but it's primarily about business processes. It's primarily about standardization. And until we are able to pivot and realize that, you know, until we could come up with standard business processes, standard business definitions, this was going nowhere. We did that, and actually, I am proud to say that as of right now, we are in flight. My paycheck hopefully will be coming from UCPath this November 30th. no, it's or we're going to have a very sad Christmas around. but this is, you know, under the current plan, we have three waves. So we're going out this November. Then next year, we'll have UCLA, Riverside, and Merced. And then the following two waves, by early 2018, this should be live across the system. And, you know, the hope is that it's going to be better service quality. And then over time, I mean, I don't see it as immediate, like out-of-the-gate cost savings, but over time, I think it has the ability to not only reduce our administrative costs, but also serve as a springboard. I mean, we're going to have a shared service center. It's an opportunity for so many different things that we do. You know, you could do travel expenses, you could do student payments, you could do all sorts of things that we currently do campus by campus, and you could do it collectively. Okay, and I told Steve that I had to throw in some. My kids know me as a perennial optimist, and so I have to throw in some of these challenges, many of which we have touched on. The first one, and I did touch on this earlier, is capital. This is another area. We talk about the $1 billion cuts from the state in the operating budget, but we've gotten no capital from the state in, you know, nearly as long. The last general obligation bond that the state passed for UC was in 2006. I think the last lease revenue bonds were 2011. So everything else that we've done, both in new capital and also in deferred maintenance and capital renewal, has been on our own dime, on our own balance sheet. And, you know, I'm hopeful that at some point we'll get another GO, but I don't think the state's ever going to come back and fund capital the way they did, you know, 50 years ago. And we're feeling it right now because we are trying to build out Merced. And, you know, when Irvine, when Santa Cruz were built, it was almost entirely done by state dollars. And with Merced, we're doing it entirely on UC resources. So, you know, this is a big challenge. We are trying to manage it. We are moving from where we're going to ask every project to actually show that they have a P&L. It used to be that they could issue bonds just based on the overall strength, but every project and every campus is going to have to show that they are that can support this. I talked about the different credit structure. Right now, all of our liens are in the AA credit, which is very, very high. I think it's important that the UC, the University of California, the general credit be a AA credit, but I don't necessarily need AA rated parking garages. And we can get a lot more capacity for dormitories, for parking garages, for other income producing if we move further down on the credit spectrum. And then we're also using other types of financing structures for projects. The biggest one right now is Merced 2020. That is it's a private-public partnership. We're going to the Regents next week to get the release the RFP. But basically, it is doing, we've done design-build projects before. We've done design-build finance. This is going to be a design, build, finance, operate, and maintain with private partners. And so it is, it's been done a lot, but generally on smaller projects. This is probably the biggest that's done in sort of the social infrastructure space. It's done quite a bit for transportation projects around the country and especially in Europe. I mentioned UCRP. Again, I think we have turned the corner on UCRP's funding, but it's still going to take a big part of our budget. This is an area that we haven't done much on. And, it's a gaudy unfunded liability, $17 billion in retiree health. I will tell you that's a little bit of an accounting artifice. Because we don't pre-fund it, we have to discount our liabilities at a very low discount rate. We discount it at, I think, 4%. Where with UCRP we discounted at 7.25%. So it's overstated, but it's one that we are going to have to look at pretty carefully. The other thing I would note is that a lot of our competitors, in higher ed, don't have a DB, and so because they have a DC, they have the outlay from the operating budget, but they don't have unfunded liability. Many of them do not provide OPEB either. So it is a challenge to us in the competitive environment. And then this is one that I think, I alluded to at the beginning, but this is, it's coming from several different sources. This was actually in the Wall Street Journal. And, it's sort of saying that higher education is a little bit of a microcosm of society, and that, the rich are really getting richer. And so this is looking at the top 20 universities in the country in terms of their overall wealth. I'd say that UC, it's listed as four here. That's misleading. It's misleading for a couple of reasons. One is about half that wealth is in working capital, the TRIP and STIP that I talked about, and we need that to support our medical centers. So it's not really the equivalent. And then you have to just look at our size. We have 250,000 students. Yale might be a tenth of that. Princeton is about 15,000 students. So if you looked at it on a per student basis, all of these publics would lag the privates. And at the same time, Harvard and Stanford, even though they have those assets, each raised over $1 billion last year. So it's big and it's growing. And this is something I started when I was at Berkeley, and I just resurrected it for this slide deck. Is what I did is I took the combination of endowment payout from some of the top competitors, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Princeton, and I compared it to Berkeley, both the endowment payout and state funds. So it's the equivalent of sort of grossing up the state appropriation into an endowment and seeing how that compared. So you can see as recently as 2001, it was very, very competitive. This yellow is Berkeley. It actually stayed fairly competitive into the fiscal crisis. But with the cuts from the state, they had a little bit of downturn because of the market corrections. You can see it now it lags well behind. And if you did this on a per student basis, it would lag way behind. And then the other thing that I think is a huge challenge about this is that, at the beginning I was talking about growth in the 4% range on our, on the state or on tuition. These are projected to grow at 7.5%, 8.5% every year. And so you can see a situation where especially the the real elite privates, where the gulf just continued to grow with the top public universities. And again, this is not just Berkeley. This is very similar to at UCLA, at Virginia, at Texas, at Michigan. It is a big concern, the growing gulf between the top publics and the top private universities. But I can't by my nature end on a sour note. So I'm going to turn back to... So this is our strategy. And I do think... I think the one thing I would say is... there was a great talk by, I think he's an economist at MIT, about climate change. And, you know, they show the trajectory of climate change and how much warmer the globe is going to get. And then he does these wedges, and there's like, you know, 18 or 19 wedges in order to keep it flat and not lead to the, you know, the 2-degree growth that's going to imperil us all. And each of those is a measure that we have to take. And I sort of feel that way about the university, is that we have, you know, there are 18 or 20 or 22 different things we need to do. And if we execute against all of them, we will have a solid and sustainable funding model. But it's not, there's no silver bullet. We can't just pick or choose which one there is. So with that, I will open it up for questions or discussion or, oh, I used a Santa Cruz mascot. Where's it's supposed to be Oski there. Celeste, yeah.
So I guess what concerned me most was when you were talking about the new, I forget what his name was, the investment officer.
Uh-huh.
And the question is, why aren't we invested in our own operations? And it sounds good on the face of it, but when I think about issues that could occur, for example, we own dormitories.
Yeah.
We want to raise fees for rent, and so we are opposed to our students. We say, well, we need those cost recoveries to fund these other things, et cetera. So that's an ethical problem. And you could see the same thing happening with investment in certain scientific or technological inventions. That is, we are now invested in... arguing for its benefit and its, that it does what it says it will do. And that could potentially lead the public to regard the university as no longer a trustworthy, student of these technologies or inventions.
Yeah. Good, very good questions and two different answers. I mean, first of all, the one on student housing is a very real one. And he and I have talked about that, and you probably want to do it in a, an arm's length, you know, have a separate organization that would look at that, because he is charged with fiduciary returns, and so if he were to put that into pension, you know, that is something that and you know, student housing is probably one that won't happen right away because there's lots of pools of capital for it right now, you know, outside of the university. But he, you know, they do own student housing in other parts of the country. And so he was looking at, well, why wouldn't we look at, you know, projects that are either part of a campus or affiliated with a campus in the UC system. And on the ventures and technology, he is going to set that up again in a he's going to have a separate board that evaluates every single project. You know, it won't be influenced by, you know, campus politics or by by the scientific community. It'll be in essence a venture capital fund that, you know, just happens to be owned or partially owned by the university. So it's really just trying to get more money into the, you know, university ecosystem at an earlier time. And again, I would point out that a lot of it he's going to be investing directly in funds that already exist. Like, you know, QB3 has two funds right now investing, and they could use more capital. So part of it's going to be investing there. But he actually would be a good person to have come talk to this group, because he's got some really visionary things for the university. Yeah.
Yeah. As one thing you didn't mention.
Thanks. Is expansion of administrative, well, senior managers, I believe they're called, right? And which there are probably a few here. And at the system-wide level, it's over the last 20 years, it's increased about 4 times, and at Berkeley, it's increased 5 times. What is your understanding of this? From below, it seems as though this is an interesting place where one could actually cut. I mean, how does one explain this enormous expansion?
Well, it first of all, I don't think it's the senior managers because I've had to testify a lot on this at the legislature, and you know this is
data from UCOP.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a category senior manager that UCOP uses.
Okay,
I've got the figures here if you want me.
But you know, if you look at over the last 15 years, there has been a lot of growth in management. Most of that has actually happened in two different areas. One on the medical center side. You know, if you think of the revenues of the medical centers, you know, nearly doubling during that time, that has taken a lot of additional administrative need. And then also on research. I mean, research has grown dramatically. So when the legislature does it, they usually do it against the number of students or the number of faculty. It doesn't take into account the growth of the rest of the enterprise that's taken place.
Well, there's no medical center here, and it's grown even bigger here than it is system-wide.
Okay, I don't know the specific numbers here, but I would also I think research has grown quite a bit on the Berkeley campus. So. Yeah, Steve.
So again, with my myopic focus on Berkeley, we're currently running supposedly a 150 million a year structural deficit, and I'm just wondering, you know, what the vision is from Oakland about how we're going to get through this. Would you care to comment off the record?
Yeah,
or
no,
even. Or even on the record, then.
We had one of our regents who said, I'd never say this in public at a public meeting. I will just say that I think that the team and Rose has been front and center, have put together some really innovative plans on addressing it. I do think it's one that is going to take several years to work through, and so we are looking at trying to support it through commercial paper, through internal lines of credit, possibly restructuring some debt in order to make it a more of a glide path, because cutting that much out of a budget in 1 year can have some unintended consequences.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about the UCOP model in terms of increasing revenue and the efficiencies you're seeing with UCPath and some of these other things, I feel, much as I did 20 plus years ago on this campus, that everybody's reinventing the wheel in their individual silo. One of the things we're recently finding is the public policy school is launching a self-supporting degree program. Mm-hmm. And the obstacles administratively and policy-wise, including up to UCOP approvals for certain things that are not, in fact, state-funded, and regional approvals for things that will not be state-funded, I think are real barriers for allowing these things to continue to have some traction, and not just at Berkeley, but perhaps at other universities within the UC system. So I was wondering if that's even on the radar screen at UCOP, and whether there's any sort of packaging that can be done. So, hey, you Riverside want to do, a strategic model here. We can help you with this is what you need to put in place for revenue. This is what you need to put in place for financial aid, and really help guide some of these. Eventually, they're feeling like startups.
Yeah.
And just wondering if UCOP is looking at that as something that they can assist with.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. I mean, first of all, in terms of the administrative barriers, I share your concern, and I think some of it is also being just a cultural shift, mm-hmm. of one where 20 years ago there were lots of reports being done for the state, lots of concern about state standards on buildings and things, and why are we doing that? I'm serious. With Merced, everyone's saying, are we meeting the state standards? It's like, I mean, we're building the best buildings for Merced. We're not going to go with CPAC, which ended 5 years ago. We're not going to go with their classroom standards. And we're trying to become, less oversight and more entrepreneurial. The president asked me and Rachel Nava, the new COO, to look at what she calls a four eyes initiative. It's like, why do you need more than four eyes to look at something before it gets before it gets moved on? No, and it's a good question. Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, if I'm the 12th person reviewing it, I don't review it very carefully. If I'm the second person, I'll take it home and read it pretty carefully. But I do think that we also I think this is one where, you know, when I talk about the governance of procurement, I think this is one where system-wide we can draw on other campuses. You know, something that's doing really well here at Berkeley might be applicable at Riverside or Santa Barbara. And
we're really bad at leveraging that.
No, and I think we're getting a lot better. We're certainly a lot better than when I was on campus, but, you know, Rose leads the CFO group, and they're much more collaborative and, you know, sharing all sorts of ideas. And so I think we're moving into an age where everyone realizes that we're going to have to take on all of these things. Thanks.
Yeah. Hey, you mentioned earlier that the president was considering accelerating the rebenching program.
Rebenching? Uh-huh.
Yeah, does that mean that they're going to be using a larger portion? As I understand, you take a portion of this general fund and give it to some of the campuses that have less per FTE funding. Does that mean that there's just going to be a larger portion of it? Or what does accelerate that program mean?
Yeah, so rebenching, it was an effort we started. We had a system-wide work group that looked at it had two parts to it. The first was called funding streams, which said that everything that's generated on a campus stays on a campus. Yeah. And so all non-resident tuition, all indirect cost recovery, all private philanthropy, everything that Berkeley generates would stay on that campus. But then in addition, we looked at some of the inequities between state funding mm-hmm. per student mm-hmm. and on a weighted basis. And, you know, the weighting we came up with, you know, you can argue with, but, you know, it was one for an undergraduate, 2.5 for a academic master's, mm-hmm. and 5 for health sciences. And so we came up with the weighting. And it turned out that, you know, there was quite a bit of disparity. The highest was UCLA. The lowest was Santa Barbara. If you were an undergraduate at Santa Barbara, you got about $2,000 less in state funding every year than UCLA. And so, you know, again, we didn't want to be disruptive to any single campus. And so we agreed to do it over a 6-year period. It turned out it took about $37 million of state funds every year. So if we got, you know, $150 million, $37 would go to rebenching, which meant that UCLA would get zero of that, and then based on where you were in the waterfall, you would get more and more. Mm-hmm. The president decided that instead of it was supposed to be through 17-18, we would do it through 16-17. And so we're taking the last 2 years. So it is a greater chunk of state appropriations that are going into that amount.
So before that plan, then there was all of that was pooled and then redistributed, and then so that plan let the campuses sort of keep their research and out of state. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.